Security Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Schwendinger and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a lovely 5-star review and follow us at Serengeti Sec on Twitter.
We're here to talk about some recent news headlines and hopefully provide some insight, analysis, and practical application that you can take back into the office to help protect your organization.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
You know, in the old days, when taking down a pirate ship, Her Majesty's Navy rarely sank commercial ships with it.
It was just a lucky bonus.
Things were just better in the past.
It was certainly a lot harder to take down a pirate in the past. Nowadays, we prime our cyber cannons and block IP addresses.
So the first article is, pirate sites ban in Austria took down Cloudflare CDNs by mistake.
Shocking.
Yeah, I'm sure we've never done that by mistake. So there's an Austrian company, LSG. Actually, I'm not even going to try to pronounce this.
That's why I was letting you take it.
My German is not up to snuff enough to pronounce this company's name. Because you know, in German, what they do is they link a bunch of words together and then make them one word. And that's what they look like here. But it will be in the show notes.
That's a very strong password.
Yeah, and it's certainly not a dictionary word for us anyway. So we'll just call them LSG, but the actual company name will be in the show notes. So this company had some copyright material that they were asking an ISP in Austria to block. And when they did that, they gave them a list of IP addresses and then blocking a whole bunch of other sites in addition to the actual pirate sites that they wanted to, because it included at least 9 IPs from Cloudflare CDN. So the copyright company, helpfully enough, provided that list of IP addresses, and the ISP just seemed to have taken that list and just ran with it. They didn't actually do any due diligence to make sure that those were legitimate, or I guess the thing is that they didn't quality check the site list to say whether they really should be blocking those IPs or not. They just blocked them wholesale. And actually, now that I think about it, it's kind of difficult. If they just give you a list of IPs, let's say you did do a DNS reverse lookup on them, how do you determine which ones are should or should not be blocked?
Yeah. Yep. And these days, with everybody using edge networks from everyone else, I don't know. Can you even block them by IP? Like, if you're trying to block bad stuff by IP addresses, doesn't the content delivery network completely get around that? Because it's the websites being served from the CDN, not from wherever it originally lived, because the CDN is copying it and serving it from their own servers.
Well, I think what would happen is it would really depend on where you are at relative to the CDN, because the whole point of the CDN is for that content to be delivered closer to you,
right,
versus farther away. And the CDN, I don't think, knows that you're not getting what you're asking for.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not routing around the block because it doesn't know to.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, I'm just thinking, when you're doing the DNS resolution, I don't know about how CDNs do that. Like, when you do the DNS resolution, does it resolve the original IP address, or is there something in the DNS resolution that can point to an IP address of a CDN if it's closer geographically? Apparently, I should have done some more research.
Actually, I didn't think to do that either.
I'm quickly looking it up. Maybe I'll figure it out in the next 5 minutes.
Because you can have, like, if you do a DNS lookup on like google.com, there'll be a whole list of IP addresses there.
Yeah, okay. No, this article does say, and I'll stick this in the show notes, when a browser makes a DNS request for a domain name that is handled by a CDN, there's a slightly different process. Server handling DNS requests for the domain name looks at the incoming request to find the best set of servers to handle it. At the simplest, it can do a geographic lookup and return an IP address for an edge server physically closest to that area. So the DNS process is different for content delivery network stuff. That's really interesting. So blocking the original IP address for the sites wouldn't have helped. They almost have to block, or they have to work with the DNS. They need to put in like a hard-coded DNS, but then the sites can get around that super easily. I wonder how they can block that if they're required to block by IP address.
Well, the thing is that they shouldn't be blocking them. They should go to the content delivery network and give them the cease and desist instead.
Yeah.
What they're trying to do is they're trying to do an end run around the actual, you know, in this case, if you want to call it, you know, a perpetrator or whatever, they're trying to do an end run around that person and using a third party in order to implement what they're trying to get done. So
that makes sense.
They should be going to the source instead of the middleman, which is why this is a problem.
Yeah. So interestingly enough, they link in the article to, it says block 14 websites. That's a hyperlink to a website where it has all the things that are currently being blocked in Austria, I guess. It's in German, of course, but it provides you helpful links. So if you're not in Austria, you can just go directly to newalbumreleases.net and get your new album releases. Or if you're on a VPN, it helpfully links you to all of the sites that the copyright place says that you should not go to. That's super helpful. Thanks, government of Austria.
Well, is that who's running that site or is that the ISP?
Oh, I don't know. West.at. I don't know who that is.
So either the ISP is being super helpful or the Austrian government is one of the two.
I think that's, internet and BIT. I bet that's internet provider.
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
Well, it could be someone at the ISP being kind of backhanded going, you know, this is stupid. We really don't want to do this. So we're going to do this thing that doesn't look like we're being jerks or whatever, in order to help people get around whatever this copyright troll is. Because this company, the LSG, this is a quote from their website, which is an extremely Spartan website. You go to their website and it's got one graphic and like five links to other static pages off of it. But in the about, it says LSG is a joint collecting society for the performers and producers of sound carriers and music videos. It administers the rights of around 17,000 performers to their lectures and performances, and also the rights of 3,500 music producers and 150 music video producers. The main task of LSG is to collect and the best possible collective exploitation of rights, participation, and remuneration claims resulting from substantive copyright law. So in other words, this is a copyright company that's the equivalent of patent trolls, where they exist in order to sue people for infringement, which I think is completely skeezy.
So are they actually being paid by the artist to do this? Or
that's hard to say. It wasn't on their info page. But my guess is that the partnership here is probably LSG says, hey, we'll sue these people and you'll get X percentage of the outcome of our suits or something.
It does say they redistribute the license revenue generated to the rights holders, but they don't tell you the distribution. Yeah, they have to make money somehow. I don't know if they're paid by them or they take a percentage or what.
Yeah. Either way. No,
patent troll seems a little stronger though. Patent trolls don't give the money back to anybody. They buy the patent, right? And then try and enforce it or at least they say that they give it back to the rights holders.
Right. Well, in the patent troll case, they are essentially the equivalent of the performers. It's like, was it Michael Jackson bought the Beatles catalog? I think it's kind of like that in the terms of the patent. But in this case, they have not purchased the rights to the music. They are representing these people in order to track down, in order to maintain their copyright superiority or whatever you want to call it.
I think this is definitely shutting the barn door after the horse is out. I think at this point, it's too late to stop pirate sites. It's too late to stop people from downloading music. You really need to be looking at other ways to monetize.
Right. And I think the copyright law in the United States is, 100 years after first production or
75
like
years or so. Yeah. Something 75 years after the author's death. For music and videos. I don't know about, it's crazy. And that's mostly Disney, right?
Yeah. Well, the law was changed in 99, I think, which is when Mickey Mouse was coming up on his 75 years where his copyright was going to expire. And they called the change in the copyright law. This is the backhanded comment. This is, it's like Obamacare. That's not actually what Obamacare was called, but they called it the Mickey Mouse Protection Act was the backhand name for that.
Yeah, that's funny.
But anyway, the reason that this even matters is that if you accept other people's data or IOCs or anything like that, where they're the ones telling you that this is malicious, you have to be careful that you are vetting that in some way, or you're accepting what they're providing you at face value as being accurate. Okay. So it's kind of like it should be a trust but verify for IOCs and things of that nature. And a lot of organizations kind of already do this today, because if you're running a web proxy like Bluecoat or something along those lines, and you tell it to block by category, you are relying on them to accurately categorize whichever sites you're blocking for, mass online storage or proxy avoidance or whatever. You're relying on them to properly categorize those as such. when you implement the blocks by category. So one thing that if you're going to do this kind of thing, you should have in place is a method for correction, preferably as low friction, as automated as possible for your users to be able to correct the miscategorization or the block that you put in place as a mistake. I'm most familiar with Blue Coat, and Blue Coat has their own site. You go to this page and you put in the URL and you tell them, hey, you've miscategorized this. And they're fairly good at getting back to you, letting you know whether that's been miscategorized or not. I've used it a few times in order to correct some issues that I've run into in the past.
Yeah. I mean, this actually kind of, I was reading another article or listening to a podcast, I don't remember which, talking about SOAR and about how everybody talks when they're first starting on SOAR about how you can just automatically start blocking stuff. You can automatically start remediating stuff. But in reality, almost nobody fully automates it. Almost everybody apparently puts a manual step in there so people can verify, because there's just so much damage that can be done by automatically blocking IP addresses and things. And that's something from my own experience in SOAR I've definitely seen. It's difficult to automatically declare something malicious because there's too many. For example, the big one is Microsoft.com. I'm going to make sure this is still true, actually. Hold on. Used to be, if you went into VirusTotal and you searched for Microsoft.com, it was declared malicious because various malicious things had contacted it. All right. So if you look at the detections are all clean, but the community score is negative 51. And nice. If you go into relations, there are a bunch of pieces of malware that reach out to this. And the reason for that is because, you know, when malware wants to figure out if it has a network connection, it reaches out to known good sites to validate the network connection is there. So depending on how you're, like, if you're doing the detections here, Microsoft.com would come back clean. If you're doing the community score, then you would be like, oh no, negative 51. This is super bad.
Yeah, I bet it's the same for Google. But of course, the community score could also be people's just opinion of Microsoft.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, so Microsoft's probably not the best one, but there are other websites I have seen that are totally legitimate websites, and they'll have like 3 or 4 detections on VirusTotal. So you have to kind of figure out your threshold for even declaring it to be automatically malicious. And then that prevents some gray. And you may not be blocking stuff that is malicious, or you may be blocking stuff that's actually benign. We just haven't gotten there to fully automate that yet.
Right. Because if you're going to tie into VirusTotal, you're going to have to set some kind of threshold, because it's never going to be 100% one way or the other.
Yeah. And it's the same thing with this. Same thing. Yeah, because Google has 0 detections, but it has a community score of positive 450, which is just, people are just like, Microsoft.
Yeah.
It's funny.
Even though Google should be down there with Microsoft, they're in the same level of evil, in my opinion.
Worse. Anyways, I don't know.
Moving on to the next article. Cybercrime groups increasingly adopt Sliver command and control framework. It was from Hacker News.
Yeah, we've talked about Cobalt Strike so much in the last couple of months. And this is definitely one of the things that's come out over the past several months, is attackers have been using Cobalt Strike more and more. And one report we looked at a couple of weeks ago said that half of all access brokers were using Cobalt Strike to maintain and sell their access. So obviously, what did the vendors do? Well, they stuck their head in the sand and they didn't develop detections for Cobalt Strike. No, they started ramping up their detections and they're trying to do a better job detecting Cobalt Strike. So what do the criminals do? Wish they would stick with it. That would be cool. But no, they're changing tactics and now they're using something called the Sliver framework.
Right. So the Sliver framework is an open source platform that was made public in 2019, created by the Bishop Fox company.
I assume that's his name, Bishop Fox. That's such a weird name.
No, there were two main guys on that.
One was named Bishop and one was named Fox. Sorry.
Oh, man, I got to look it up now.
Shut up. I'll shut up. No. Vincent Liu is the CEO and co-founder. Francis Brown is the other co-founder. So yeah, neither of them, or maybe that's their code names.
Their hacker names? Bishop. The Bishop and the Fox. It's like spy.
Yeah, maybe.
Spy names.
I mean, it is security. We're all supposed to have cool hacker names, right? They have a lot of vice presidents. Good Lord.
Are they a financial institution? Because that would make sense.
No, I'm just looking at their about us to see they've got a lot of financial officers or a lot of VPs. I really like VPs.
Who doesn't?
I would love to be a VP. I don't want to work, but I'd love to be a VP.
Wait, are you saying VPs work? Come on now.
Anyways, I'm sorry.
We're talking about too much fiction on this podcast, all right? All right, so technically Sliver is actually still in beta, even though it came out in 2019. And it has a whole bunch of really good features from a pen test/red teaming. So it's got user extensions, staged and stageless payloads, dynamic code generation, local and remote processing injection, what they call anti-forensic, Windows process migration, and something called multiplayer mode. I'm not sure exactly what tag team pen testing.
No, Well, kind of. I looked up in their wiki what that is. And what that is it lets you set up a command and control server that multiple people can log into and interact with the compromised systems at once. So you can work as a team or you can, like hand off parts easily.
I see.
So that's kind of cool.
But there's a huge list on their page, on their GitHub, about what the tool can do. And it's pretty robust. So this is apparently, Slivers is from, they got the name from Magic the Gathering.
Really?
Yeah. The Slivers are the best five color creature tribe in Magic the Gathering. Each Sliver is connected to a hive mind and takes on the abilities of every other Sliver, exponentially increasing in strength as they gather.
Yeah, if you bring in a sliver that has flying, all of your other slivers have flying. There's like muscle sliver gives every sliver +1/+1. So, yep. That's really interesting. Sorry, was that too nerdy? I apologize.
Hey, if Vin Diesel can write an introduction to a Dungeons and Dragons manual, then you can be Magic the Gathering nerdy on a podcast.
Speaking of Magic the Gathering nerd, did you know that Post Malone plays Magic the Gathering? It's all right. I didn't know who he was either before. But apparently he's super famous. He's an American musician. That's fair.
Yeah, back in my day.
Yeah, come back and tell me when Johnny Cash plays.
Yeah, exactly.
In hell.
He won't be doing that anytime soon. So at least one major APT currently is using this, and they're being tracked as Dev 237 or Fin 12, and they've used it to deploy Rio Conti, Hive, and Black Cat ransomware. So other cybercrime actors are also adding the Sliver C2 framework to Bumblebee.
Oh my, I don't know what to do with that. It was in the article, but it does seem like there's not very terribly well used so far, though. Although obviously this is, early days for Sliver, but.
Yeah, but what's also interesting about this is they're moving from the Cobalt Strike, which is a commercial supported, paid tool, to an open source one.
Yeah. I wonder if there was also some pressure on them from Cobalt Strike to try and better figure out who they're selling stuff to.
Oh, so maybe you mean Cobalt Strike may have been tightening down on where their software goes?
Maybe.
Or maybe it's way it's managed.
Because I'm sure the people who own Cobalt Strike are not real thrilled about this kind of publicity.
Right. Yeah, because they may have been getting pressure from governments or something like that, which was cutting into their profitability or something. Because otherwise, they're like, well, we'll sell it to whoever will buy it. Like, yeah. What's the ones who write the Pegasus malware?
Yeah, NSO Group.
NSO Group, right. Like, hey, we'll sell it to anybody. We'll just claim that we don't.
Yeah.
But I'm also wondering if it had something to do with the fact, since it was out in 2019, why is it picking up now? So it could be possibly they released the version 1.5 in January, which is not backwards compatible with version 1.4. So it could be that something in that release is something that was really important to their ability to leverage it for doing this kind of access. And also migrating from open source to, or not migrating from, migrating from the commercial product to the open source reduces their overhead, because I think we may have talked about this before, where it was necessary for them to use a cutout in order to be able to get Cobalt Strike, which the open source, obviously you don't have that requirement anymore because you don't have to purchase it.
That makes sense. Almost as an afterthought, the article also mentions that there is a suspected, quote, suspected Russian state sponsored group that has started using a, quote, legitimate adversarial attack simulation software called Brute Ratel, which is curious that they call it attack simulation software. I looked it over and it looks more like it's a C2 framework rather than an attack simulation software. When I think attack simulation software, I think of something that a corporation uses to improve your defenses.
Right. But, why would you do a simulated attack when you're doing an actual attack?
Or you almost
doesn't make any sense.
And if you're doing a simulated attack, you almost don't want it to be too good unless you're such a mature organization that you're ready for that. But then if you're such a mature organization, you're going to be using other, you know, like Cobalt Strike. So I don't know, it was weird. But that being said, they linked to a study, and that study only found 7 samples on VirusTotal dating back to, I think, February 2021. So last year and a half. So it's not a big player yet, but that's something else to consider. Now, the company said they took action on the license sold in the black market. Was it really sold in the black market, or are they just reacting to this poor, you know,
the publicity
news? Yeah, the publicity. That's the word I was looking for. I don't know that answer.
All right. Well, if you're waiting for this stuff to get in the news, you're already behind the power curve, though, as far as the migration of where the attackers are moving to. You know, by the time they've pivoted from Cobalt Strike to the Sliver network, by the time everybody's starting to look for the Sliver network stuff, they're going to be pivoting to something else, probably.
Yeah. So, and I don't think it's, I know that I actually wrote that on there, and I'm on one hand, yes, like the fact that we're seeing about this. They mentioned, for example, that Brute Ratel one's been being used for a year and a half, and we're just now starting to get public intel on it. But on the other hand, these are still only being used by a couple of adversaries. So you still do, like, it's not like, oh no, we've been hacked for 6 months and we're just now finding out about it. It's we're behind the curve, but we're not that far behind the curve.
Well, I guess it really depends on how hard you're looking, though. Because if you're waiting for this stuff to pop out in the headline or something, then I think it's too late. But if you had an active team that's doing research or paying close attention to what's going on on the attack side, I think you are going to be out front on this.
You know what, though? You're right about it. There's because it's people above and below the security waterline. Because there's people that have a threat intel team. They're fine, probably. Like, they're able to take an article like this. They're able to start looking for this in their environment. People that are relying on the vendors to provide their detections and they're waiting for the update, like, those vendors are still working on Cobalt Strike. They're not moving on to Sliver, and they're not going to move on to Sliver until, you know, 50% of the APT groups or 50% of criminals are using Sliver. And then they'd be like, oh, wow, we should do something about this.
Yeah, I would say if you have a red team, or if you enter into an engagement with a red team for a periodic check or a pen test or something like that, you should probably have a conversation with them about the tools that they're using and what they're seeing other pen tests or other red teams doing as well, because those two tools are going to be very similar to the ones that the attackers are using.
Yep, and you'll definitely want to start looking. If you have an MSSP, as so many companies are, they should have a content team. You should be able to push them and tell them to start working on Sliver detections and Brute Ratel detections, and maybe working on detections that aren't specific to certain frameworks. Maybe things like statistical C2. I mean, if all of these, for example, can use DNS command and control, and you don't necessarily need to specifically detect Brute Ratel to detect DNS command and control. And depending on how difficult your network can be, baselining is always a good option too. Although I know a lot of people work in places where the network is not easy to baseline, unfortunately.
Yeah, and if you've got a team, I don't know if you'd be a threat intel team necessarily, but if you got a team that's tracking new malware, paying attention to new vulnerabilities and that, you might want to add additional line item or tasks for that group to also pay attention to new red team tools and techniques.
Yeah, it probably should just be part of their dev cycle in between they shouldn't be constantly doing red team tests, right? They should be training and practicing new tools and stuff like that.
Right. Because the Sliver tools and the Cobalt Strike tools, those are not attack tools to start with. They're red team tools to start with. So if you're at the cutting edge of what red teams are getting, you know, and developing, you're going to be also at the cutting edge of what the attackers are adopting as well.
And we'll talk about more about that next week. Next week, we look at an interview with a ransomware, and he has very strong feelings on blue team folks. Last article for today. is a short one. Hopefully this should be 5 minutes or less. We'll see. James Webb Telescope images used to hide malware from Malwarebytes. Steganography is a common problem in Capture the Flags, but I don't think I've ever seen it in the wild. Yeah, well, that always makes me wonder, like, do we not see it in the wild because it's not being used in the wild? Or do we not see it in the wild because it's so hard to find? Because there's so many pictures going through that it's, unless you have something else to point it out, you're never going to find it. But anyways, Secure Onyx found an actual attacker using Stego in a malware campaign. Campaign seemed pretty traditional up until it downloaded the final stage of the malware, which was hidden in a JPEG from the James Webb Telescope.
And of course, the fact that it was from the James Webb Telescope, that's really coincidental. That could have been any image could be used in the same way. It's just that the James Webb Telescope, it just got launched and they're just starting to come back with these high res images. So everybody's really interested in seeing it. It's like, you know, when COVID was big, there were a lot of phishing campaigns from COVID and, you know, whatever is the zeitgeist of the moment, you're going to see the attackers glob onto that.
Oh, I thought this was alien malware that was downloaded through the telescope and then imprinted in the pictures. I guess.
Wow, that would be awesome.
That would be kind of awesome.
I doubt if aliens are writing in VB. They're probably using Python.
Yeah. All right. So it starts off as a pretty standard phishing campaign. There's a Microsoft Office attachment, which downloads a malicious template. So the Office attachment itself is not malicious, but it references a malicious template, which is on a website that is not the normal Office template. And that template has a Visual Basic script that runs when the user enables macros. The VB script then downloads a JPEG file. Totally benign. Those silly hackers must have made a mistake, obviously. JPEG files can't be executed, except the JPEG has a bunch of Base64 code hiding as an included certificate. They use certutil to decrypt it and then save it as an executable. So a couple of things. Is the cert considered part of the image? Is this actually considered a stego? Like most of the time, at least in Capture the Flags, what they consider stego is where you're, you know, modifying the least significant bit and hiding stuff in the picture that way.
Yeah. I don't know. It wasn't clear from the article exactly how the cert is with the JPEG. But typically when you're using steganography, you have to have a special tool that pulls that data out of the image. So it seemed like this is more like attached to the image or something like that versus actual steganography.
I mean, but still, it's still neat and cool. And
it's so unique.
Oh, steganography is defined as covered writing. In essence, we use the name steganography for every technique that conceals secret messages and something that doesn't immediately cause suspicion. All right. Well, in that case, this is steganography.
Right. Except for the steganography is not in the image. It's in the cert, which is attached to the image. Yeah.
So in looking at that, I'm actually super curious if an average analyst would recognize that a Base64 encoded executable is not a normal cert. So if you open up a normal cert in a text editor, it looks like gibberish. The biggest difference would be, can you recognize that it's Base64 as opposed to the distinguished encoding rules which are used to encode certificates? And the length is the biggest thing. Certs that I've seen are typically fairly small and they'll show up within a single, like you don't generally have to scroll to see the entire cert. But this was a 1.7 meg executable. So a lot of scrolling there. But I don't know that your average analyst would be that familiar with certs.
Certainly not. They expected to view the cert. They would not attempt to view the cert in a text editor either necessarily.
Oh, that's fair. If they tried to view the cert in a cert viewer, it'd probably fail unless they did. Maybe the top part of it was like a legitimate cert. I don't know. I'm sure it would screw up the way it showed up in the cert viewer for sure. Then they further obfuscated the malware by using ROT25, which is really interesting. They went to such extensive lengths to hide it, and then they just used a rotational cipher. That's wacky.
Yeah, but this is also written in Golang too, which is a cross-platform language. You're seeing more of this where they aren't using something that, you know, is platform dependent.
So why does this matter? Well, this is just your weekly reminder that the bad guys are constantly updating their tactics. And it was also super cool. Again, you don't see much steganography. Well, although by that larger definition of steganography, I guess you probably see a lot of steganography. You don't see image-based steganography.
Right. And of course, this highlights again that you should disable macros in Office files. You know, and if you're going to set that up as the default, that doesn't mean that macros can't run if you need them to, but there's extra steps that have to be taken in order to enable the macro. It's just not going to run automatically. And you can do some logging with this, but the logging is not great. You know, some of the logging that you're going to be able to get out of this is just a file where that had the macros enabled on it.
Yeah. And an EDR would be super helpful here to watch for, because you should be able to see the MS Office file that's doing the call certetl and download the malware, download the JPEG, and then call certetl and decode it.
And in this instance, the commands that were run were all, it was a chain of command line executables. So you could probably use command line process auditing to track that as well with your EDR.
Yeah, there's actually one interesting thing here where certetl-decode, and then it had the JPEG file. That would be, I mean, that's probably not a real common command line. You may be able to just look for certetl*.jpg and look for any, I mean, I don't know how often it happens, but I would assume that'd be a pretty high fidelity indicator.
Well, you may be able to go to something even simpler than that. I mean, how often is the dash decode switch used on certutil?
That's a good question. Yeah.
So one of the things you could do when something like this happens is audit your environment to see how prevalent these kinds of executions are, because it could be that this is a rare thing that you could start looking for right now or working as something to possibly investigate. So you're making your detection broader than this one instant in case someone else tries something very similar.
Yeah, and that's commonly what certutil is used for, right? That's part of their living off the land stuff is decoding. So yeah, that'd be a good one. Take a look at least see how often it happens. So, and maybe a dashboard that has the rarest certutil command lines might be interesting.
Right. And this is something you can do for a lot of things, because the attackers are using the living off the land techniques, but a lot of the actions, well, maybe a lot is a bit of hyperbole, but some of the actions that they take place or that they do is not something that your regular admins do at all or frequently, in which case you can generate reasonably good alerts or detections for those kind of actions that, while it's a legitimate admin function, simply aren't typically done within your environment.
Well, that looks like that's all the articles we have today. Thank you for joining us. Follow us at Serengeti Psych on Twitter and subscribe on your favorite podcast app.